music indicates we're circulating at a cocktail party, talking amongst ourselves. That's pretty much what we'll do this morning on the panel. We have a wonderful group to do it, and we welcome you to come in and take off your coat, get dried off, circulate, have a appetizer, order a drink at the bar.
It sounds like a nice after-work holiday party, Joe. Like, let's do it.
After work?
Nice lunchtime activity.
We all have coffee cups in front of us, but we don't know what's in them.
Mine's Irish, in
fact. Indeed. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. It's a delight to have you all with us, and I thank you very much for being with us on this Thursday. Rainy day, good old-fashioned rainy day, which is good because, good Lord, we need the rain. So that's good. We'll take it, and hopefully it's a good hard-soaking rain that will help some of the situation that we are currently in. I mean, ecologically. Although perhaps it can help other seeds grow as well. We welcome the following individuals to our program. Of course, you are always invited. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Anna Markowitz is here, an advance lead for the White House and former chief of staff for State Senator Michelle Hinchey and former assistant county executive for Pat Ryan. Good morning, Anna. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
It's really nice having you here. Thank you very much for being with us. Judy Patrick joins us, vice president for editorial development at the New York Press Association. Hello, Judy. How are you?
I am fine. Happy to be here.
Happy to have you here. And Nick Rangel joins us, executive director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York. Good morning, Nick.
Good morning, and it's good to be back even on this beautiful rainy day.
Yes, indeed. It's wonderful to have you all here. Thank you very much for taking the time out and making us a part of your day. It means a lot to us, and we really do look forward to the conversation, even though it's, you know, the conversation. So let's talk. We'll begin with the Matt Gaetz story. And I know. And I don't know. Hold on. I've just lost track of my 1 second. Anybody have a funny story to tell us? I'm looking for, I had my, all my stories in front of me. And
it is hard to keep track of the Matt Gaetz stories.
Oh, there we go. Yes.
So many of them.
I know. I'm having trouble with my tabbing system. Okay. So a federal inquiry traced payments from Gaetz to women. Now, I find this interesting, and I don't know, here's the story, and then I'm going to ask some questions. One is that, so a document prepared by federal investigators bolsters claims by women who say they were hired for sex by Matt Gaetz. Matt Gaetz, you may remember, is the president-elect's choice for attorney general. He denies any wrongdoing. Gaetz is accused of having taken part in drug-fueled sex parties, according to the document obtained by the New York Times. Among those who received money from Mr. Gaetz were two women who have testified that he hired them for sex, according to the document and a lawyer for the two women. The lawyer said payments to the women ultimately totaled around $10,000. In the New York Times coverage, there is a very convoluted graphic that shows the Venmo transactions between all of the individuals who had a part in this as of September 14th, 2020. The two main individuals who are where that all of the arrows emanate from, one being Matt Gaetz, the nominee for attorney general, and the other being his buddy, Joel Greenberg, who I believe is currently in jail. So there is that, and that is confusing. Further confusing is that the Justice Department failed or declined declined to charge Mr. Gates with a crime when they had the documents mastering the investigation, and they have remained secret. The thing I don't... Let me just ask this question right off the bat. So earlier this week, we heard that someone had hacked into the Gates investigation, but they didn't believe that that information was released. And now this information comes to light. Can we make an assumption that that is where that came from?
Well, it could have been leaked.
Yeah. Well, that is what the Gates people are saying. They're saying Democrats leaked it to make it look bad for Gates.
Well, somebody leaked it, and thank goodness for the Free Press for printing this extraordinary graphic, which is like this big spider web that shows these payments going back and forth, primarily through Venmo. Sometimes they were PayPal. But we should note that Greenberg, the other person in the center of one of these strings of webs, is in jail for sex trafficking related to all of these things. You know, it's been interesting to watch the support or the defense of Matt Gaetz from Republicans who say, well, the Justice Department didn't pursue any charges associated with this. And I would wish I could see a full report from Congress to see exactly why it could have been that maybe there wasn't justification for sex trafficking.
Although there was enough there to continue the ethics probe by the House. So even though the Justice Department said there was not enough, in their opinion, to further the investigation, they did say the House Ethics Committee said we want to continue looking into this.
And I just don't think that the bar for this kind of level of an appointment should they be in jail, right? Like, okay, well, they didn't quite meet that threshold of in jail, so let's give them all of the power of the Department of Justice. Like, that just doesn't seem like the right move.
Are you saying maybe a different bar of, okay, you don't have to be in jail, but maybe you shouldn't be Attorney General?
I'm saying that. I mean, obviously the bar has been lowered. Donald Trump himself paid hush money to a porn star for having sex with him. So he himself doesn't believe that that should bar anybody from high office, say presidency. Same thing with Elon Musk. He tried to go to a sex club in Germany and according to reports was turned away at the door. I don't know how accurate that is. But so this is something that this crew thinks is like a socially acceptable thing that we just shouldn't be, you know, caring as much, I guess. I personally care, but.
Can I ask? Go ahead, Nick. I'm sorry.
I mean, you know, it does get to the question, like, should prostitution be a crime and at what level of responsibility? But the Matt Gaetz issue involves an underage child, right? So, like, I do just want to parse out. I don't necessarily think it's, you know, unethical to engage in prostitution, but it is illegal. And when it involves a minor, it is, you know, highly offensive and criminal, right? It's a felony in Florida where this happened.
Right. So you're bringing me down exactly the road I wanted to go down to and filled in all of the proper background information. So my question was going to be it's in New York, the person, the 17-year-old would not be a minor. In Florida, they are a minor. And people are making that argument, which I don't quite understand because the law is the law within Florida, and that's where. But then there's also the sex trafficking aspect to it, and oh, by the way, there's also the drug aspect to it.
It's just sleazy, and also let's remind listeners that Donald Trump was convicted in a civil court of sexually molesting a woman. So it's we hear this word so much nowadays, but the normalization of sexual abuse. And I think Donald Trump is saying, no big deal. I'm going to surround myself with people who have been also accused of this because I don't think it's a big deal. And it is a big deal. It's just sleazy. It's this is the top law enforcement officer in our country. This drip, drip, drip of information coming out is, I would think, undermine his investigation. What I do not want to see, to be honest, is a full-throated Senate confirmation hearing, because I think that will put the women involved through the same kind of torture and abuse that Christine Blasey Ford went through. I mean, it might make good TV. It might make great spectacle. I would wish he withdraw before we got to that point.
But it's going to be, I mean, but who knows? I can't see that happening, but yes.
I think it's also interesting to think about, like, you know, the privilege here that we're affording Matt Gaetz. How many people are incarcerated for using the same drugs he has been found to have used? How many people are incarcerated for engaging in prostitution? How many law enforcement departments target women who are engaging in prostitution where they don't target men in the same way?
By the way,
you're the attorney general? Like, how?
Allegedly cocaine and ecstasy, correct? Right. So how many people are in jail for those,
I mean, Florida hasn't even legalized marijuana for God's sake.
and these women get arrested for prostitution and they acquire all these arrests, and it makes them difficult for them to ever lead a life outside of prostitution, which is a tough life for any woman to live. So, it's a self-perpetuating, approach to this.
But I don't know. This is not a world I know about. But the way it has been described, though, are these sex parties that they had fairly regularly, that there was this group of people, and that's where all the money is going through, and there was a whole network, and it was like it was a business. And that seems quite horrible and insidious.
It has very Epstein vibes to it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, but hard. I mean, we've had a difficult time in the past of making any of these things stick to the person to actually have it be that they will pay some consequences for what allegedly they did.
I'm okay. You know, I just don't want him to be attorney general. But again, I almost think, well, I have to think that this is just, he's the sacrificial lamb. They know this one's not going to get through, but at least everything else is going to go through in the meantime. But because we're so focused on the Matt Gaetz confirmation. But again, this piece of information got leaked. I wish the whole report would have been leaked, but that will happen, I imagine.
I am curious about the ethics committee reports and their, you know, foilability, because they, you know, they are public documents. So there has to be some aspect of those reports that has to be foilable, I think. Mm. It's not the same as a federal investigation. It's right. A House investigation, right?
Because we paid for it.
Yeah, it's owned by tax dollars in some way.
At one point, a Trump spokesman overnight described this as a classified document. It's not classified. It's not. I mean, this is a classic.
He said, once again, it's the Democrats leaking classified documents.
Right, not classified.
Right. Sorry, no, that was Trump that
documents.
Had the classified document scandal in the bathroom, not the Democrats. Nice try.
Nuclear stuffing secrets, and toilets. Things like that.
So and then as we look at this, so the House was deadlocked yesterday putting this out. So is that done deal then, or can they, or will they continue to try to?
They could try to bring it to a vote of the full House and put some people on record about whether or not they want this report released. That might be very indicative of where the House is going to go forward. I mean, Johnson has come out and stuck his finger on the scale, his thumb on the scale, saying he doesn't think it should have been released. I think ethically that he should not have weighed in on the Ethics Committee decision until they had actually done something. He clearly tried to influence their decision. But, yeah, I'd love to see a full vote of the House before early December.
I'm going to ask a really silly question. Get ready. They had to know that this was, I mean, everyone knew most of the, even most of the details that were reported in the Times today were reported in an article in one form or another 2 years ago. So it's not like the president-elect's transition team didn't know all of this was going on. But you do wonder at some point, do you say, oh, is this a good idea? Like, can we?
Well, I mean, you know, Trump is going to protect women whether they like it or not. Right?
Yeah, I think they just don't care, or yeah. Or I think that a good point was made about that this could be a distraction from other appointments. So I think that we should be really vigilant about trying to do as much as we can to get senators to vote no on some of these appointments.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. Anna Markowitz, Judy Patrick, and Nick Rangel make up our panel this morning. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll get to some of those letters, and we'll move on to other topics after this short break and news from the BBC. I realize that there will probably be many moments like this in the days and weeks to come. But yesterday, I was bereft, for want of a better term, of just thinking about the actions of the United States Congress yesterday, in which they remain deadlocked on releasing the Matt Gaetz report, and said that Mike Johnson and the spokesperson said for the Trump transition team, Stephen Chung, said Matt Gaetz will be the next attorney general. And so they worked really hard within the halls of Congress yesterday to make that the issue. And the other issue, so that was to allow someone who is accused of being a sex trafficker and attending drug-fueled parties with minors to be the attorney general. So that's that. And then Sarah McBride, the incoming Congresswoman from the state of Delaware, the first out transgender person elected to the U.S. House of Representatives, the House in all its glory votes that regarding facilities throughout the U.S. complex, they will not be able to be used by a transgender member of the House.
Or the public.
Now, so I have many questions about this. First of all, I don't really understand what they're worried about, because have any of these congressmen ever been on a plane? Like, there's just one. You go up, you go to the bathroom, and you come out. Like, that's it. What's wrong with that? Like, I don't get it. I don't get it. And I just, so there's that. But to your point, Nick, right, not just for Sarah McBride. And all single-sex facilities in the Capitol and House office buildings, such as restrooms, changing rooms, and locker rooms, are reserved for individuals of that biological sex. And this is where I don't know the law, which I'm hoping you can help me with, Nick. But is that not discriminatory? Is that not Is that not against the law?
So I don't think it's against the law under the federal law. It would be against the law in New York State, but not in the Capitol. I just want to note that this came on the day of transgender remembrance, which remembers the tens of thousands of people who have been murdered because they are transgender. And this is a targeted attack and an effort to bully a woman who hasn't even been seated and is a distraction, really, from the many, many gross and unethical things coming to light in the House and among its own House members. And it's just so many things. So McBride will have her own bathroom in her office. She'll be able to use the unisex bathrooms, which there are unisex bathrooms in the Capitol as well. So this is really a change to gender-specific bathrooms and bathrooms that are shared, multi-person bathrooms, right? But it's the message, right? It's the messaging. Lauren Boebert said she would physically fight a woman coming out of a single-use bathroom if she thinks or believes that that person is transgender. Like, how offensive and gross is that outlook, that you're going to watch somebody come out because it's not a multi-use person bathroom. It's like you're saying, it's a single-use bathroom. Somebody comes out and like, oh, I think because I have a gender bias and I hold sexist ideas in my mind, I'm going to start a physical fight with somebody who's just using the bathroom. It is like crushing to the soul, I think.
So, right. Absolutely crushing to the soul. Mike Johnson said it is important to note that each member office has its own private restroom and unisex restrooms are available throughout the Capitol. Well, right. So then don't bring it up as an issue. Then just not make it an issue. It's the then taking it to women deserve women's only spaces that is the thing that will make your head spin.
But those women also have their own private bathrooms, right? Like, if you don't want to share a bathroom with somebody else, you can just go to your own office private bathroom, right? And I think what's also interesting is the use of the term biological women. And it's also interesting that they're not talking about transgender men at all. But biological women, it lacks any relationship to the medical science around transgender identities and transgender people, because the notion of biological women is kind of a false narrative. And it's remarkable that electeds who have no background in this medical science are deciding that somebody who's assigned a sex at birth is therefore that biological sex, which is false on its face. So there's that.
The other thing about this, and I know, you know, you could go on and on about this, and I there's just so much that I am trying to understand, but in the choices, in the picks for the cabinet, the president-elect keeps on saying that people around the president-elect keep on saying that these are picks that are made because this particular in this election, he has a mandate and we should give him the cabinet that he wants. I would just like to point out that Sarah McBride handily won her district over the Republican by at least 9 percentage points. I would even call that a mandate.
I thought that she really handled the attack well.
Beautifully.
I didn't come here to argue about bathrooms. It's like, yeah, show them what you did come here for.
I'm working on housing.
Yeah.
I'm working on food and food insecurity. Yeah. That's right. She handled it beautifully. Absolutely beautifully. But
it's still disappointing.
The
but
issue
she shouldn't have
exists.
To.
Exactly. Yeah.
Like she shouldn't have to do that assimilation performance in order to be able to just do her job.
Mm-hmm. But the Republicans have taken transgender issues and run with it. They thought it was very successful with them during the for them during the presidential election, and clearly they're not going to let this one go and expect to see more of this craven political grandstanding. I think who was it? Nancy Mace, who is the leader on this one? It's just wrong, and I think it's one of the reasons everyone on both sides of the aisle tend to dislike Congress.
So what's her problem?
Yeah, what is her problem? Because and what is all their problems with? Again, I agree with you. Have they ever gone to the bathroom on an airplane? Or I have been in enough situations where I've seen people attacked, not a challenge for being in a bathroom where some person suspects that they shouldn't belong in that bathroom, and you can't help but feel great empathy for the person who's just trying to perform a basic bodily function at a public bathroom and being attacked. Rightly, it's just wrong.
I find it that to be the order of the day. And yet we keep having this conversation. It's a chicken and egg question of why do we have to talk about this? And yet, like, okay, and I know, like, I wish we could talk about other things, but I think it's important that we do because it's just it's so egregious in my mind. But we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. We'll return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this morning. We welcome you, panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. All right, letters. We go to Susan. As a lobbyist, I wandered the halls of the House, and I dearly hope the bathrooms aren't closed to the public. Also, it's laughable to think anyone will be around to police the bathrooms. The building is mostly populated with young staffers who are busy doing their own work. Then Clayton says, full stop, homophobia, pure and simple. Mary, it isn't about bathrooms. It wasn't about water fountains. Then we go to this note, I believe, from R, who says, dear panel, don't you realize that the joke is on us? Matt Gaetz will be the next attorney general because of our new dictator-in-chief. And he wants him to be. We're laughing at the thought of him as attorney general, but let's not forget that we also laughed at the idea of Trump winning the election. These are not normal things anymore. Trump's win means that corruption has now reached the highest level of our government. The larger tragedy here is that we can no longer view our government as one that will always stand for what is right in the world. And then we go to Carolyn, who says, so I have a question. Where is the outcry from the evangelical Christians about the Gaetz nomination, or is sexual abuse okay with them?
It's a good question. It's all, you know, where was their outcry over Trump? I mean, he's not necessarily a moral man, even though he sells Bibles, so there's that. I mean, if you ask him to quote something from the Bible, he wouldn't be able to. I think they accepted Trump for their own, the ends justify the means for political organizations. And apparently that's the deal that they have struck with someone who, again, has been convicted of sexually abusing a woman in civil court.
Mike writes, with what we know about Matt Gaetz, it is apparent that he would be an easy target for blackmail. That alone should disqualify him from being the head of to be the attorney general. Then we go to Russ, who says the chairman of the House Ethics Committee is Republican. No report naming Gates will be issued. All other allegations are the product of illegitimate news purveyors such as the New York Times. Trump is fond of scofflaws, and if he wants to run a criminal enterprise from the White House, there's nothing to stop him. He has two MAGA-dominated legislative bodies and a neutered Supreme Court. That from Russ.
I'd actually say it's an empowered Supreme Court.
And I would say it's a legitimate New York Times. I think discrediting the mainstream news media when you don't like the news they're producing, their basic standards the New York Times follows in terms of vetting documents that they receive that are leaked to them. They make sure that they're correct before they print them. I have every faith that this, you know, Venn diagram or what, it's not a Venn diagram, it's this chart that they published,
yeah.
is accurate. You going forward, we need to rely on the news media to provide us essential information that the Congress won't release, that people are hiding. It's going to be harder and harder going forward because under the Trump administration, they're going to be taking a very hard look at leaks and comments to the press. So buckle your seatbelts, Joe.
Yes, Judy. Ray writes, the transgender issue you were discussing is another example of MAGA forces reminding us all of Trump's promise to protect all women, whether they like it or not. That was Nick's point earlier. And how sad and how threatening, says Ray. Wanda Sykes, the comedian, hit the nail on the head, writes Patricia, when she pointed out on the Jimmy Kimmel Show that Republicans have managed to make an issue out of transgender population, which is less than 1%, and have convinced people that climate change, which affects 100% of our population, is an absolute hoax. Oh, remember when things like that were funny? I think that is it for the immediate letters before me.
I think that is the point, right? The point is to distract and occupy our minds, our thoughts, our efforts around issues that, you know, deeply affect and are extremely important, but to a small portion of the public, so that we don't have the bandwidth to also tackle the, you know, universal issues that are, you know, putting our lives at risk, right? Like climate change is having a tremendous impact on the globe and also the United States, and in really acute and specific regions, we're facing some of the biggest and worst forest fires and forest fire conditions in the Northeast that I've ever experienced and can remember at all. And we just don't have the bandwidth to tackle both things at the same time in some ways. It's like you have like this bad news like bandwidth that just gets exploited by GOP, you know, circus performances, and it's really difficult to say we can tackle both things, we should tackle both things, but we're talking about the headlines instead of this
right,
you know, the forest fires, for example, or the tremendous change in average temperature in the capital region, which is, you know, being seen in our lifetime as just,
and just the
extreme changes.
The drought nearby and the fires and the Berkshires and dot, 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 dot. Juan writes, this reminds me of the part in Monty Python where the knights ask Sir Arthur to cut down the largest tree in the forest with a herring. Do you think that Matt Gaetz is a red herring, and should we be more worried about who is actually coming to the table? I think we can worry about it all.
Yeah. But that's exactly it. Yeah. Like
we need to resist, right?
We have to fight the impulse to focus on just the circus and look at the tree for the forest or whatever the analogy is.
And we can't be beaten down.
I think the herring was the analogy. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that so many people feel powerless after Trump has won the second term that they're giving up fighting. And I think that now is exactly the time that we need to find the right way to fight back.
So keep that in your mind, because I want to come back after the break. We have a story about just that, of sort of the resistance to this. And I think it's a really interesting story that we put on the docket this morning that we'll get to in the second part. When we come back from the break after the top of the hour, I did get another. Roger writes, I'm feeling that we're all passengers on the Titanic, and we can see the iceberg and what's going to happen, but we can't change it. I'm not looking forward to the next 4 years. Well, I don't, and I think this just gets into what we were just talking about of keeping our, doing the best we can and keeping our eyes open and trying to understand and put the pieces together.
Right. We can't be fatalistic about this because we have no choice but to go forward and to stand up for the values we believe in you hear this a lot from people. You got to start listening to people. The only way we're going to stop being this polarized society is if we start to come together on small things and then slowly build back up. I think that many interactions we'll all have today, and all of them should try to be based on some element of kindness and listening and trying to understand. I know that's very naive of me to believe that maybe the institutions work, but I think we have no other choice but to do so.
I don't think it's naive of you at all. I think it's impressive that we have two other panelists that you said that and they didn't yell at you.
We both worked within government. Yeah. I'm like, protect the systems. Build them into what we want to see.
Judy floated that balloon about a week ago. It didn't go over as well with the other members of the panel.
Know your target market.
What were you going to say, Nick?
I suspect, I'm not sure where I land on this, but I've been like noodling on it, that I think that in some ways, yes, people feel a little bit powerless. Yes, people are a little disenfranchised and maybe disillusioned. But I think there's also this interesting like trust in the process that still exists for a lot of people that, yes, Linda McMahon is poised to take over the Department of Education, but maybe that won't be so bad because there is the deep state. Like there are these structures that exist that would slow down and disrupt and make it very, very difficult for somebody to take over as a head and then just like fully dismantle an entire department, over an entire agency over a relatively short period of time, something that's been built up and expanded over so many years. There are laws, regulations, much of the things that are in those talking points would have to be acted on through legislation. We know that legislation is not known to actually move through any body particularly quickly. Most bills live in the New York State Legislature for at least 7 years before it gets adopted, if it ever passes at all. And so, like, the size of government does, in a way, also preserve its, like, conservative little c nature, that change is slow because of how many, regulatory and functional structures are in existence. And so to some degree, I think people are like, oh, who cares? Like, they're not going to get that much done. The things that really matter, people will galvanize around, that many of the policies that the like ultra conservative people are using as talk points are actually supported on a bipartisan level. Much of the funding that they're talking about eliminating is actually supported at the bipartisan level. How many people would lose their seats if early education ended? How many people would lose their jobs if they could not send their kids to preschool and publicly supported daycare? Like, the concepts are so big that when you look at the details and on the ground, they're not just unrealistic. They're sort of nonsensical. And I think a lot of people kind of feel that in some way, that they're just talking points and there's not actually a way to effectuate. Now, is that true? I mean, I'm terrified. I don't know. Like, I know a lot of people are actually also scared. And so I think we're like kind of tentative about, like, let's see how quickly, how aggressively, how assertively, let's see how much. I mean, we saw the House completely fall to pieces and be completely incapable of functioning. Was it last year? God, COVID years don't know. I don't know how to count them.
It was in the fall, I think.
It was last year where they had no speaker and they were like fighting amongst themselves. Like, maybe they won't get anything done. Oh, hala. But, you know, it's hard to know. It is very tentative, and I do think people have some level of faith, like, in government.
I sure hope so. I think that this is really going to be a litmus test. This is going to test, like, all right, if you know someone's intentions are to dismantle the entire Department of Education and the entire EPA, and they didn't succeed the first time because of all of these structures that slow them down, but then you give them 4 years to plan and come up with Project 2025 to identify how they're going to do it, and then you reelect them, are they able to accomplish it the second time, right? I think that that's the question that we all are asking, is like, how effective are these systems? Can they really withhold this threat when they have all, you know, the House, the Senate, and the Supreme Court?
I mean, we might be giving Project 2025 a little bit too much credit. Like,
I hope so.
There's an outline and a wish list, mm-hmm. but there's not really a roadmap. Like, it doesn't mm-hmm. specify what would have to happen for the Department of Education to be completely dismantled. Like, it doesn't go to that level of detail. And frankly, the people who know enough about the regulatory and statutory frameworks that would have to be overturned, would have to be brought up and voted on, is vast. And those people aren't coming and saying, hey, you know what you really need to do? This is the law that you need to, like, end this, right?
Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned. It has been 1 minute and 49 seconds since I have gone to news with Ray Graff. I will do my penance and go to that now. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Anna Markowitz is here, an advance lead for the White House and former chief of staff for State Senator Michelle Hinchey and former assistant county executive for Pat Ryan. Vice President for Editorial Development of the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, is here. And Nick Rangel joins us, Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York. Welcome all. I'm Joe Donahue. It's 9 minutes past 10 o'clock. We welcome you to be a part of the program, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And we would love to hear what is on your mind. Let's go to some other topics here that are of importance and things that we want to get into this morning. And we do so in this story, which is that we touched on this earlier, and I want to get more into this, which is an article in the New York Times called "Get Somebody Else to Do It, Trump Resistance Encounters Fatigue." And Anna, you touched on this earlier in our conversation. In the days after Donald Trump's electoral victory, thousands of people revived the grassroots movement that opposed his first term in office. Marchers in Manhattan took over streets carrying a block-wide banner that read, "We won't back down." Activists in Los Angeles and Chicago decried Mr. Trump's abortion and immigration policies and vowed to descend on Washington to protest his inauguration in January. But participants noted that Mr. Trump had not appeared to be swayed by protest petitions, hashtag campaigns, or other tools of mass dissent. Many have been calling for a fresh playbook. I thought the first women's march would be a turning point, said 45-year-old Laura Bartek, a nurse from Virginia, referring to the protest with nearly 500,000 people that took place after Mr. Trump's 2017 inauguration. To be here 8 years later with these signs, Ms. Bartek said during a recent protest in Washington, it just breaks my heart. I keep getting emails to sign petitions, said Leslie Mack. These people coming to the White House don't care about petitions. They don't care how many people sign them. They don't care what they say. The first Trump presidency spawned the largest protest the country had seen in half a century. But not everyone wants to participate in another 4 years of mass movement work. When Women's March shared information about an upcoming rally on Instagram, one person responded, "Okay, but no, I'm tired. You all have fun, though." The Women's March later hid some of the pushback and limited those who could respond to a handful of posts to keep it more positive. On TikTok, plans for a march were met with some memes of women saying, okay, why don't you get somebody else to do it? This is an opportunity for a national brunch day for the 93%, said one user, referring to the 93% of black women who exit polls suggested had voted for Vice President Kamala Harris.
Yeah, so I don't think people are wrong to feel like marching isn't the answer. It's hard to feel like, okay, well, at the first time, people didn't know how upset we were. So we told them how upset we were. And then 8 years later, here we are again, and they've heard us. It's not that they don't know. It's that they don't agree. And so I think that we need to take this time. And if it were up to me, and I've been getting a lot of this question because I worked for the campaign, I marched in 2016. A lot of people are like, well, how do I resist now? What do I do? And I'm open to a lot of suggestions and actions as well. But my thoughts are, A, we need to go to all of the swing states. We need to go to all of the swing districts that we might win in 2 years for Congress and listen to them and say, what could we do next time? What is the messaging that we need to have? What are the actions that we need to have you vote for us in 2 years so that in 2 years we have control of the Senate or the House? We need to make sure that he doesn't have this trifecta for all 4 years. That would be devastating. So I think that that needs to be a huge push. I think that we need to, you know, after 2016, I joined my local Democratic committee. I focused instead of the federal government, I focused on state government and local government. And I think that we need to strengthen the areas of our country that we do have control over. And, you know, and I think that if we kind of do that kind of work, that we're at least moving in the right direction. We can't give up. We have to make sure that we're blocking all of the appointments that we can. We need to make sure that we're like doing work at the federal level to resist as much as possible, while at the same time building at the state level and like setting ourselves up for success in 2026.
Nick.
If I was in a Zoom, I would do like a plus one. Yeah, I mean, 100% agree with Anna. You get to be upset and you get to mourn and you get to have your feelings. And I think it's also important to note that not everybody who is progressive was on board with Harris. And I think it's important not to dismiss those voices and to make sure that we're listening on all sides of sort of the blame game, if you are. But like to go in and to just really understand where this campaign could have done something differently and do a deep dive on how would that have changed the voting patterns in those blocks of voters, because it's unfair to have these like sweeping assessments like, well, you know, these people didn't vote this way and those people did vote that way, but really listen and then boots on the ground. I mean, so much of it is boots on the ground. Mm-hmm. And if you can't put your boots on the ground, you can donate, you can amplify, you know, you can, there's lots of ways to be involved at your local level in your community. It doesn't have to be big P political. There are lots of education opportunities. There's lots of outreach on specific issues, right? There was so much misinformation around Prop 1 in New York State and ERA that people, like, I know very few people outside of legislature who actually know what the language of the Equal Rights Amendment did and was and meant to do, even like across the political spectrum. And so there was clearly, you know, a lot of opportunity to do more education and to do more information on issues as well as on candidates.
So dissent is the bedrock of American democracy. It's what helps us function well because we voice our objections when we don't agree with whatever government is doing. But I should mention that all of the mass protests of the past have taken years. I mean, when we talk about right. the peace movement of the 60s, the effort to get better care and research into AIDS took years. One big march in Washington by women is not going to do it. So there's a persistence element that needs. You can't just, nowadays our society, we want things to happen so quickly. And so I would argue that you should not just throw your hands up and say marches don't work, protests don't work. Because keep in mind that it really annoyed Donald Trump. All the protests annoyed him. At one point he suggested during the George Floyd protest that they send troops out into the streets to shoot them in the leg. So it does bother him. I think it also bothers I think it gets their attention when you write letters to the editor. Liz Cheney's book, she references something from Elise Stefanik. She was upset because people were writing letters to the local newspapers in her district complaining about something. So that does make a difference. I would encourage people to go on Blue Sky. It's the alternative to Twitter. It's booming. It's a social media site that is like the old Twitter without the right wing. Amplified without all the crazy Elon Musk things.
How does that algorithm work?
It's a self-perpetuating algorithm. I made the mistake of liking something about gardening and wine, and I'm getting a lot of that, but I think I can change it over time.
You may not want to.
But it's true. But it's like, again, it's...
Think about your choices.
It could be worse.
Right. Things had gotten so toxic in another environment for me that I searched out another source of social media that I found that worked for me. So there's, you know, keep your mind open to that. Antonio Delgado has an op-ed, I think, in the Washington Post and the New York Times today that talked about the need to govern well. That, you know, one of the things Democrats can do going forward is the bodies that they do control to do it well, to show, to demonstrate to their constituents, to even people around the country that perhaps there is a way to run government efficiently and for the good of the people that that they can demonstrate to the voters going forward. So there's a lot of positive out there. Thanksgiving's next week. Let's be thankful for the things that we do have, which is the ability to speak up when we don't agree with what's happening.
I do. I want to just second Judy on civil disobedience and the importance of free speech and organizing and being visible out in public and in public spaces. It is tremendously impactful. BLM had a number of setbacks, but in many, many communities had many, many successes and celebrated real moves, real changes in local policing policies, in local communities, in budgets on the local level. And that kind of work builds up and it does then catch and spread and become, you know, part of a new norm over time. So I would just suggest that people find their organizers on the issues that they care the most about and organize and exercise their free speech.
I'm curious, though, in the I agree with everything that everybody said, but I also take from that the article that I read as a setup of that idea of people being exhausted, just really tired. And I know you can't afford to be, but I understand it. And I think it's an interesting, so people are given a choice. Of course, we all have the choice. Are we going to do something or are we going to say, all right, but Yellowstone's on. Go ahead, Nick.
But I mean, you know, political fatigue is not new. And you're like, the three of us are women. And I'm a Hispanic woman. I'm a Hispanic woman with lots of other intersectionalities. And we've been fighting since, I don't know, for a couple thousand years,
right,
for like basic human rights and equal access to just our own bodies. I understand that there's fatigue, and fatigue, you do need to practice self-care. You do need resets. You do need a nice spa day. But these things don't happen without everybody, every single person being willing and able to keep moving forward.
But yeah. If that is a mindset, I'm just wondering what changes it. And it seems to me that a part of what changes it is leadership and people who are leading a fight or leading a movement to try to change particular things. And I'm, A, would you agree with that statement? And B, are those people out there doing that work?
Yes, there are people doing that. There have always been people doing that. Yes, there are really remarkable leaders. There are remarkable leaders in our community in the Capital Region, and I am 100% confident there are leaders in every other region. I think sometimes their voices get drowned out. Sometimes they also need to take a break and reset. Sometimes they also need a spa day. And sometimes it's not fair to say that the most marginalized, the most vulnerable, the most disenfranchised people are responsible for leading the charge to some big, new, and absolutely traumatic and exhausting fight. Like, maybe sometimes the folks in positions of privilege and power should take that on and take some of that work on themselves.
Amen. All right. Let's go to Melinda, who says, dear panel, an organization called Indivisible has come up with a set of strategies we need to use to resist. It's called Indivisible.org. I do not know about it, so I just passed that on.
Were very big. They formed after Trump was elected the first time, and they had like local chapters throughout the country, I believe, definitely throughout the state, and were very active, especially in the marching and
Pat writes, I notice that Trump supporters feed off our fear and outrage. They get emboldened and push back really hard, irrationally and ferociously. There has to be a better way. Sue says, although I generally am a glass half full sort of person, I am finding it hard to be that way with this new administration. When you put really horrible people at the top of the agency, it has the effect of making the next level down think seriously about staying if they have another option, as they know that nothing purposeful will come down their way. I have a good friend who was pretty high up in the EPA but left for California when Trump got in the first time. This time around, I'm certain the erosion of good talent will be far greater as people know for sure what is coming, which will have the effect of eliminating roadblocks to Trump's plan, and legal rulings that exist now can be overthrown by the Supreme Court. Then we go to Sherry. So you guys really think Trump won't do whatever he wants when he's in there? Okay. You guys keep taking the high road.
I've had so much time to noodle because I've been hiding from the news. So my noodling, I think when we're like, how far is too far? Like really too far. And I do think like Brendan Carr's appointment to the FCC, and I think their position on freedom of press is something that we really need to be aware of. And I was like, Judy, can we talk about that today? Because that appointment announcement, I think, came out yesterday.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And how he engages with the military, right? Like, those are really the two things that would have the most significant and immediate impact and, like, move towards, a truly authoritarian governing system. And so if we're like, do we really think Trump can just go and do whatever he wants? I mean, he can't actually order the arrest of Hillary Clinton. That's not a real thing. But if he tries, like, that is a real thing, and that would be the red flags, right? Like, those would be the alarms. So we're actually pretty far away from, like red alert alarms at this point, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's anyone. I mean, of you guys really don't think. I don't know that we're taking the high road by questioning as to what is possible and what isn't possible. But thank you for thinking that we took the high road.
Well, and what's the low road? I mean, what do we do if we want to take the low road?
Just roll over and say, "Oh, well, good work."
Oh, yeah, it's fight fire with fire. I don't know. The FCC appointment is incredibly potentially dangerous if it encourages, it starts to allow more aggregation of television station being owned by one person. And we see this a little bit now with the Sinclair chain. You don't want one voice. You want independent media, because when you have independent media, many of them, you get different voices and different perspectives. I mean, the Wall Street Journal has a different editorial perspective than the New York Times, and it's important to hear both sides of that, even though the Wall Street Journal also is criticizing all the Trump nominations in many respects. But that's just an example of why different voices are important. And if the FCC starts to even by just mentioning the possibility of not renewing licenses for radio and television stations, it has a chilling effect on you're worried about what you're going to say going forward. So you need a regulator in line that respects the ability of the media to express different opinions and speak and act independently. And I'm not sure you're going to get that with this guy.
I think we'll still have a show.
Well, 4 years is a long time. I mean, it's not going to happen all in the first 6 months.
I know this isn't all about us, but...
but 4 years is a long time. A lot can be accomplished in 4 years.
You should be applying to jobs at X right now.
although, apparently, everyone in the cabinet has been a talk show host. So I guess
you
that's
have a chance.
That's a good chance. James writes, with all due respect to Judy and everyone else, we have to realize that conversations with Trump supporters is no longer the same. Now that the election has passed, MAGA Republicans don't see us as simply people with different views. Trump's win is, for them, proof that we here at WAMC are the ones who are nuts. Trump supporters feel that they need to talk us into joining up with them. Are you ready to be talked into wearing a ruby red MAGA hat? I, for one, am not.
Hats are not a good look on me. Never going to wear them, no matter what. Not a good look on Donald Trump either. I don't know.
Elon has a much better look, the black hat, you know.
It's appropriate he wear a black hat, yes.
But not all people who voted for Trump are MAGA GOP members.
Correct.
And not all people who did not vote are Trump supporters.
Correct.
So, the majority, the vast majority of the electorate in the United States do not see things as black and white as the most extreme people in that party. And I just think it's dangerous to alienate and to be so divisive and to use divisive language to end conversations with people who do actually just have different opinions.
Mm-hmm. We'll pause there. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up our conversation with our panel, and we'll do so after this news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our conversation this morning. Anna Markowitz, Judy Patrick, and Nick Rangel on this 21st day of November. It is 10:34 on a Thursday morning. We welcome you to the proceedings, and we thank you very much for being with us. And we appreciate you being with us. Excuse me. We would love to have you join us in the discussion. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. All right. Did anyone want to say anything else about the FCC pick?
No. Just just stay alert. Be mindful of what's being broadcast. And the FCC is it's not an organization or a department at the federal level that people normally follow, and it's especially hard given the loss of people covering the media nowadays. So there have traditionally been a very boring agency, but pay attention. I imagine the pick's going to go through. His nomination will probably be approved. It's just be vigilant. And I think radio station owners, television station owners, and anybody in the media needs to take care with this going forward.
No pressure, Joe. We're looking at you.
No pressure.
All right, let's talk about eggs. Grocers report egg shortage ahead of holidays amid surging bird flu. Avian influenza has affected more than 108 million poultry in 48 states since 2022, lifting prices and diminishing supply. While most grocery prices have stabilized this year, one supermarket staple keeps getting pricier and pricier and even tougher to track down, and that is the edible, incredible egg. It was frustrating to shoppers at Trader Joe's. Take two. It was frustrating to shoppers at a Trader Joe's in the Union Market neighborhood of Washington, D.C. on Wednesday as they walked past an empty refrigerator with a sign that read, temporarily out of eggs. One customer worried she wouldn't have eggs to bake for Thanksgiving. I hate going to grocery stores, so when I go and I can't get what I want, it's unpleasant, she said. Not too far away at a Whole Foods market in Logan Circle, only duck eggs, quail eggs, and organic pasture-raised eggs were available. By the way, very reasonably priced. A sign informed shoppers that the store was limiting egg purchases to 3 cartons per customer. We are currently experiencing difficulty sourcing eggs that meet our strict animal welfare standards, it said. Eggs have vanished from many U.S. grocery shelves in recent weeks, sparking customer fears that a shortage could coincide with the holiday season. Egg production in the U.S. dropped 2.6% in October from a year ago. It projected to decline 1% in 2024 compared to 2023. The most recent shortage has a familiar culprit, that is bird flu. A devastating outbreak of highly pathogenic bird flu first hit birds in the U.S. in February of 2022 and has since impacted more than 108 million poultry in 48 states, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Avian flu outbreaks in Utah, Washington, and Oregon last month resulted in the loss of 2.8 million birds and forced the USDA to reduce its egg production estimates for the end of 2024 and start of 2025. More hens are dying from avian flu, and the remaining flock isn't growing fast enough to compensate. Bird flu is by far the biggest factor involved with egg prices, said an economist at the American Farm Bureau Federation.
So it's important to note that this is the time of year when local egg producers will see their supplies go down just because the lack of sunlight, the hens stop laying as many eggs as they do come June.
Right.
So this is, I tend to get my eggs from a local farmer. He has had a tough time keeping up with that. Eggs are a staple. I need them for my pumpkin pie next week. On my favorite new social media site, Blue Sky, they've been talking about eggs, and it's gone from like $3 to $10 a dozen. So it varies all over the country. It's something still, I would argue that even at $5 a dozen, which just seems to be the normal price I've been paying lately, it's a good deal. It's a good nutritional deal when I'm paying $7 for a bag of Oreos. Just saying. The price of butter's come down for me, so I'm pretty happy about that as baking season commences. But this is a something people should be aware of. It's bird flu is something that the farmers in this industry have to get a handle on, and the government has to play a role in helping them do that.
It is interesting because I have a also
get you our, have a source.
I have an egg source, and Judy and I live in Washington County, and there are a lot of farmers and chicken coops, and so we go by but I sort of have been following the story and thought that the reason that eggs were not as prevalent was because of this, and was told that this is sort of a natural cycle, which makes the problem difficult too. But even local farmers are having issues. But hopefully that it will return.
Right, and I'm happy about my butter coming down because Lord knows I go through a lot of butter from now until January 1st. if anything, it's probably good for my cholesterol that, the prices have been so high. But again, it's a staple. People really rely on eggs for a cheap source of protein. It's far more cost effective than...
I picked up my Keller's butter turkey. Yesterday.
How was that price?
Well, I don't care. I don't. But you know what I'm saying? They have butter lambs, and then they have little butter Santas. They have butter trees, and then they have butter. I've had these since I was a little kid. They're a dairy in Pennsylvania, but now they're available. So they have butter turkeys. So I have the turkeys made out of butter, the way they're sculpted. You get maybe a quarter of an ounce of butter, but it's fine. It's
price like per ounce is like $17.
Yeah, pretty much. But I agree with Judy. It's pretty good. Yes.
So I think the thing that should rise to the top here is that since the pandemic, SNAP benefits have been cut by 70% in most of this country. WIC has a specific list of foods that you're allowed to use WIC benefits to buy, and eggs are on that list. Food stamps also have a list of foods that are allowed to be purchased with food stamps. Eggs are on that list. Eggs have gone up 28% in cost, and we know that grocery stores in low-income neighborhoods add a convenience tax, if you will, and have even higher prices because people don't have choices on where to go. And we also know that some of the poorest people live in food deserts. You get to one grocery store to try to use your food stamps and your WIC benefits. You can't find eggs and you can't use those benefits on many kinds of food items, right? And so, I think holiday baking, making meals for your home, but also all of the nonprofits that are trying to make meals for people who can't afford their Thanksgiving dinners. It is beyond how it impacts my mom. My mom bakes in our family. How it impacts my pecan pie.
Your mom is a hell of a baker.
I know. Really, I've been dreaming about this pecan pie for a while. and so I think we have to remember that these staples, these household staples, when those prices go up and we are cutting benefits to the most vulnerable people, have an outsized impact that we just need to keep in mind. And everyone should donate to the food pantry. So,
well, right, and to your local food pantry, and dollars is better than food because they can get things cheaper, but it is often it's difficult for them to get it too many times in those items when they try to put them on the shelves. I'm worried, very much worried sick about SNAP benefits. Now Dr. Oz is apparently going to be in charge of this, and because it's a Medicaid program, SNAP. And we're looking at the proposed Trump tax cuts and where that money is going to come from. And apparently it's going to come from social programs, and SNAP is one of them. And looking about especially how that impacts rural areas, And I'm, you know, I will say very specifically, like, where Judy and I live, we have a high poverty level. The rate of poverty is very high in the county, and a very subtle shift in those numbers can be catastrophic as far as the number of people who will be below the poverty line.
Yeah. And then tying it into the political landscape, this is the kind of issues that voters vote on. Like, if they can't afford eggs in their fridge, like, that directly impacts their day-to-day life. They can't make breakfast for their kids in the morning. So, you know, we need to be taking care of our most vulnerable.
And also what we do about the overall problem about avian flu, how we also address that issue, which, as I mentioned in the setup to this, has been going on for quite some time.
I mean, one of the things, from my understanding, which is limited, admittedly, but from my understanding, one of the reasons things like avian flu and other diseases spread so quickly and drastically in the mass production of our food sources is because of how overstuffed, overcrowded, overpacked the industry allows animals to be kept for agricultural purposes. And so, you know, there is this opportunity to kind of reflect on how agribusiness is conducted and the safety precautions that would also improve the quality of life of those creatures as the vegetarian in the room. But, you know, I think, like, we kind of create this problem, really, as part of how we've developed our agricultural industry.
So does your – do you eat eggs –
I eat eggs, but I do try to buy local, free-range, you know, gamey-tasting eggs as much as possible.
So it doesn't affect the pie?
You know, no, I don't think so.
Yeah, no.
You know, you put enough
sugar.
Whipped cream on it.
Sugar fixes everything.
I'm definitely like a Cool Whip and put the pie inside of the container of Cool Whip. And it is pronounced Cool Whip, you know, Cool Whip. I'm lying. My mom makes fresh whipped cream. So if you don't know, she's a great baker.
She is.
Okay, I'll be coming to your house.
Yes.
Good stuff. All right. We are out of time. I want to thank everybody for being with us on this Thursday morning edition of the Roundtable. My thanks to Anna Markowitz, Judy Patrick, and Nick Rangel. You're all wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing with us this morning. We got through a lot.
Thank you for
having us. Thank you very much. We'll continue on the roundtable and forge ahead after this short break.